Okay, well, thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here. To give a, a presentation on an entirely new paper that a young colleague of mine, Jehi Choi, and I have prepared for a special issue of Structural Change and Economic Dynamics. Paper is an outgrowth of a much larger research project, which has been going on now for 25 years practically, and whose primary objective has been to use administrative data sets, mostly data sets relating to payroll and employment by sector, by industry, by geographic region, in order to build out dense and consistent measures of inequality, mainly for the purposes of international comparison, that's to say countries and years. And that's been something that we have done through a great many different data sources, of which one particularly important one was the industrial statistics of the United Nations Industrial Development Organization, which we used to construct an estimated household income inequality data set, which is now the largest consistent set of inequality measures available that does not involve interpolating across years or across countries as some data sets do. In other words, entirely based upon information for each year in each country. And we've shown that this is a very sensible and reliable way to construct measures of inequality of various types. In this particular case, it's gross income of households. And that using that, one can find patterns in the data, particularly transnational patterns, the effect of globalization, the effect of financial globalization, the effects of debt crises and the collapse of the socialist bloc and so forth on inequality in particular moments of time around the world, particular countries. And so that's what the broader project has been largely about. And you can explore the details of it at the website whose address is given here by looking up the University of Texas Inequality Project. And there are now 74 or 75 working papers available that describe this particular effort. But what we did here was to bring the focus back to bear on the United States and in a particular way to ask a very specific question about the relationship between economic inequality and the patterns of voting in presidential elections in the United States. An issue which is of considerable interest, particularly since we had, as you may have noticed, a fairly dramatic election 3 years ago in 2016, which pitted two candidates, one of whom, the ultimate victor, was exploiting very aggressively the anger that is felt by a part of the American electorate about its economic conditions or its perception of its economic conditions. And so the question that we wanted to ask was, what is the relationship between economic inequality and electoral outcomes in the United States? If there is, in fact, a systematic pattern or relationship, and did Mr. Trump exploit something that was important that exists, or was he merely, in a sense, whipping up a response to a demagogic appeal? This is a question which has to be approached with some care in the American context, this is because we have a very peculiar way of electing presidents. You can see the pattern of the U.S. vote on this map, but it's done by county. With the blue representing counties carried by the Democrat Hillary Clinton in 2016, and the red representing counties carried by the Republican Donald Trump. And there is a distinct and interesting sort of pattern of contiguity, if you like, across the Democratic regions. The Republican ones are much more extensive geographically. But you begin to see some things which suggest a hypothesis that we will then develop in the course of this paper. The important point, though, about the United States electoral system for the president is that since the beginning of the Republic, it's been an indirect system that involves a peculiar institution called the Electoral College. And I'll take a minute because Mario last night, when I was initially calling this paper The Electoral College Consequences of Inequality, and Mario said to me, well, people won't know what the Electoral College is. The Electoral College is who you vote for, actually, when you vote for president in the United States. You're voting, the name is of the presidential candidate, but the people elected are members of the college. And they are in principle committed to voting for the candidate who achieves a plurality, it's a first-past-the-post system, in the state to which the electors are, from which the electors are running. The number of electors is approximately proportional to population, but not quite, because it's equal to the number of House seats in the state, which is proportional to population, plus the number of Senate seats, which is two for each state. So the small states have a minimum of three electors, or four if they have two congressional districts, and they thus have a larger representation relative to population than the big states, which may have 30 or 40 congressional seats, but still only two senators. The other thing that's a little bit odd about this system is that it's not entirely clear that electors are actually committed to vote for the candidate who is who carries the plurality in their state. In two states, actually, the law specifies otherwise. Those are Nebraska and Maine, each of which has, I think, four, Nebraska maybe have five congressional districts or a bit more, but in any event. In those states, electors are elected or apportioned by congressional district, and if a congressional district has a plurality for a candidate, one elector will vote for that candidate while the others will vote for those who carried the state as a whole. It's also possible for electors not to vote for any candidate who was on the ballot. And Washington State, this actually occurred in 2016, as some electors who were initially running as on behalf of Bernie Sanders ended up as electors for Hillary Clinton. And rather than voting for her, they decided they would try to spark a rebellion against Donald Trump by voting for Colin Powell, who of course was not a candidate for anything, but they felt perhaps as voting for a Republican, and in particular an African-American Republican, they might get some Republican electors to go along. Didn't happen, of course. I have a picture here of the faithless electors from the state of Washington who were in court because the Democratic Party has sued them for $1,000 each for failing their mandate. I mentioned them in particular because the woman in the center is one of my oldest friends. She was my high school sweetheart when we were 14 years old, and she played the flute at over my parents' graves in 2008. So I'm very close, and I have promised that if she loses the case in the Supreme Court, which is being defended by a Harvard professor named Larry Lessig, I will pay the $1,000 fine on her behalf. So but anyway, let me get back from that personal digression to give you the basic thesis or schema that we offer for this paper. And it is very simple, that if one looks at the allocation or the preferences of American voters, you can find that we have a two-party system in which one of the parties tends to be very strong, not in the middle of the income distribution, but on both of the tails. That is to say, the Democratic Party is a party which has strong majorities amongst relatively wealthy, mostly urban professional classes, and also very strong majorities amongst the lowest income populations in the United States, who are very largely ethnic minorities, African Americans, Hispanics, and a small number of Native Americans, who have a Democratic propensity to vote, let's say on average of 0.8. It's about 0.9 for African Americans, about 0.7 for Hispanics. Whereas the population which is in the middle of the distribution, which is substantially suburban and rural, tends to be heavily white and tends to be heavily Republican. And so our thesis is a very simple one, that states which have the flatter income distribution, you can see the blue, let's call that a log, is distribution of log incomes, therefore fatter tails, will tend to have a larger share of Democratic voters. And states which have a narrower income distribution and that are therefore more egalitarian in their internal structure will tend to have a larger share of Republican voters. And this has nothing to do with the attitude that voters have toward inequality, but simply with the demographic composition of individual states and the peculiarity that states go for the presidential candidate according to the, in a winner-take-all fashion, according to the plurality of voters in that state. And what I've done is to create a little schema in which I give a kind of what we call a three-part triptych representation of a state according to whether it is has a larger representation in the middle or the extremes of the distribution. And you can see the two states here, one of them conveniently a red state, which is what we call Republicans, and the other one a blue state, which we call Democrats, represented as a 0-1-0 for the Republican state, that is to say, more than 50% basically in the middle of the distribution. And in the Democratic state, a 1-0-1, which is to say, more than 50% on the two tails of the distribution at some notionally chosen division between the center and the tails. So this is a very simple idea, very simple model of the choices that American voters make. And what we suppose is they're basically that one can think of the American electorate as having three basic classes. Obviously, you could make it more refined than this because there are different propensities in different parts of the structure. But let's call it a low-income, largely minority community, with a Democratic preference that's on average about 80%, and a middle-income suburban rural community with a Republican preference on the order of 70%, and then an upper-income urban professional community with a preference for the Democrats also about 70%. Now, I'm making up those numbers. I haven't got them precisely calibrated. I'm not basing this on an extensive survey, but it sort of gives you an idea of the basic idea that our thinking is that within each of these communities, the proportions of voters for one part or the other can be thought of as being approximately the same, no matter where you are in the country. There are no part of the country, for example, where the African American vote is Republican, or even 40% Republican, just for example. So that what happens in each state depends, in our thinking, primarily upon the balance of the population, let's say the economic structure of the state. And that, of course, changes over time. So just to work this out as a kind of hypothetical exercise, you can look at this table. And I won't go through all of the examples, but let's suppose we have a state in which you have 50-50. Well, that state might be, in this case, slightly weighted toward the low-income community compared to the high, and therefore slightly weighted toward the Democrats compared to the Republicans. A state which is upper-middle, the state that might be, for example, Minnesota, extremely close. And Minnesota, and in fact, which are very few poor people, only went Democratic by a little over one percentage point in 2016. An extreme middle-class state, very little rich, very little poor, would be a heavily Republican state by this calculation. One could go down the list. a state which is extremely, which is polarized, would be substantially a democratic state. That is to say, a state, well, we'll get to specific examples. A state which is only got, which has got a lot of poor people and minorities, but not, and middle class people, and very few rich. That's a case like New Mexico. There are not very many of those cases, but there are a few. Substantially democratic. Again, middle class state, somewhat less extreme, would be somewhat less Republican, but still solidly so. And in an extreme case at the bottom, you have something that looks like the District of Columbia, maybe not so much now as 20 or 30 years ago, when it was much more heavily African American than it is now, with a very strong, as on the basis of that, very strong Democratic vote share. So that's the idea. And again, those numbers are notional, but what we contributed in this paper was a set of measures. And to do this with reasonable precision and get it right for a country with a changing demographic and inequality structure, we needed to have annual measures for each state. And this was a problem, because annual measures of inequality for each state have only been done officially since the year 2000. So only in the last 15, 18 years. Before that, annual measures, state measures for each state were only available once every 10 years through the decennial census. And you had those, but that was still 10-year intervals. While there was an annual survey of current population survey to get inequality at the country level of the country as a whole fairly accurately, the problem was that with only maybe 60 to 80,000 households in the sample, there are a lot of states for which you don't get enough people covered to be able to get a really reliable estimate of what's going on in, let's say, a small place like Rhode Island or North Dakota or Wyoming, with a very small share of U.S. population. You're going to have a lot of noise in an income inequality measure, which is drawn out of a subsample of a sample size of that kind. So what we did, and this was the contribution that essentially drew on our larger inequality work, and it's, I think, not that dramatic really, but it required a certain amount of legwork to do it, was that we went to a different data set, the employment and earnings data set of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and drew out information by sector, which enabled us to develop a measure of inequality between sectors tile index, which is what we use as a standard statistical measure for much of the work of this project, for each state, for each year, going back to 1969. And then we calibrated that to the decennial census, so that we were looking at something that is our best estimate of what the Gini coefficients for household income inequality was for each state. And then we have a block of data that is complete, balanced panel for 51 entities, the 50 states plus the District of Columbia, for each year from 1969 to 2014. Okay. What do these measures show? If one goes back to a much earlier period, let's say the middle of the 1970s, and you pick up inequality measures by household income for that period, you will find, and I think it's no great surprise, that the biggest, the United States was a very substantially middle-class country in those days, and the biggest inequality measures of the country were in the Deep South, and they reflected the racial divide. Extreme poverty of the African-American population, and the relative prosperity, but actually not so much the prosperity of the white population on a whole, but the existence of a middle class that was largely on public payrolls as a result of the New Deal, say federal employees of various kinds, also state employees, and that was where your solid incomes were, and many of the other of the larger population were sharecroppers and people with very, very low cash incomes. So we're not going to apply this theory to that period, but I'll give you this is not changes in inequality, sorry, my mistake on the heading. This is the level of inequality 1975 and the election outcome in 1976. Sorry, I did that title just before coming out here and I neglected to change it. It's Levels of Inequality and Election Outcomes in 1976. It's worth noting the key, which is we use red circles for Republican states, blue diamonds for Democratic states. The scale of the diamonds and the circles is weighted by their electoral vote share. And so what you can see is there's essentially no relationship between inequality and voting outcomes. Maybe a little bit in the, no, there's no relationship that you can tell. The states that are out here on to the right of the diagram are overwhelmingly southern states. So I see Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, Florida, Alabama, Kentucky, Texas, Tennessee, and Georgia all in the top echelon of most unequal states. This situation, if you look at changes from 1969, well, there's not a lot of time. There's essentially no relationship at all. You wouldn't expect there'd be one. So that's sort of a baseline for an analysis of the data. But the situation of the country really changes. It changes, and the changes become increasingly deep as time passes. The beginning of a period of major structural change is really the early 1990s, and that's what I'll demonstrate here. In the 1980s, with the start of my own professional career when I was serving as the staff director of the Joint Economic Committee in the Congress, we had a period of severe dislocation associated with industrial recessions that were provoked by extremely high interest rates and other features of the fiscal and monetary policy of the time, extraordinary upvaluation of the U.S. dollar, which destroyed the competitiveness of a great deal of what had been the World War II center of American industry and heavy industry and machine tools and so forth in the Midwest, in the upper Midwest. And following that, in the 1990s, there was a substantial recovery and transformation and globalization of the U.S. economy, which resulted in a shift of the economic center of gravity out to the coasts. New York had always been an important center for finance. This spread all across particularly the east, northeast coast of the country. And the West developed on the basis of aerospace, military technologies, and ultimately, as the 1990s progressed, information technology, all of which had a strong element of public scientific contribution and played critical role in Northern California in the state of Washington. In the southern part of California, you had aerospace and you also had the entertainment industry, which is, a pole of inequality, because these are all industries in which very small numbers of people reaped a very large share of the gains. As that happened, a pattern of changes in inequality beginning in 1969 or 1990, I'll show you both just to show you that the data don't depend upon the choice of baseline. Began to show a very distinct pattern. In the 2000 election, which was Al Gore and George W. Bush, you can see that the states which had the larger increases in inequality are distinctly more likely to be Democratic states, Gore states, than the states where the increases were somewhat smaller. This is using the Gini coefficients calibrated to census incomes. The previous one is just using the industrial sectoral data, the same pattern basically. If you go to 2004, which was Bush's second election against John Kerry, again, you can see the pattern becomes, a little bit more distinct. You go, again, 2004, it doesn't really matter whether you use the tile or the Gini. An interesting thing using the Gini is that you can see there's a state, Nevada, with a substantial increase in inequality, still Republican in 2004. This will not be the case afterwards. So go to 2012 for Barack Obama's re-election. I'm not going to use 2008 because that was a landslide election, and obviously some things can just change the whole picture. But 2012 was a somewhat closer election, and now you can see Nevada has flipped to a Democratic state, and there are essentially no states with large increases in inequality that are voting for the Republican candidate. And then one goes, that's the, using the Gini coefficient. Here you can see using the Gini coefficient, there's another state with a substantial increase in inequality that's still in the Republican column, that's Arizona. Arizona stays in the Republican column in 2016. In 2018, it returns a Democrat to the Senate for the first time in many decades. So you can see the changes are going on as we speak. What am I doing? Oh, I've run the wrong, just looking at the wrong thing. There we go. Now we come to the election of 2016. Based at 1969, this is the pattern. Based at 1990, this is the pattern, essentially similar. So you can see that most of the changes I'm talking about are in fact changes that have occurred since 1990. And in this case, all 14 of the states with the largest increases in inequality since 1990 voted for Mrs. Clinton, every one of them. States with smaller increases, there are a smattering that voted Democratic, but they're predominantly Trump states. It's a very clear distinction. It's a very clear distinction. And one can go using the 69-based Gini index and the 1990 Gini index. Essentially, the same story holds no matter what metric or what base year you're applying. The other thing that we did was to run a regression, actually a series of regressions, of the Democratic vote share against the change in inequality based at 1969, and I'll show you 1990 momentarily, to see at what point if the standard errors give you, a high degree of confidence that the effect is a significant one. And lo and behold, before 1992, as I say, before this point in the data, the effects are they're not statistically clear. But after 1992, in every run, changing the index, changing the base or changing the index, in every case, you're looking at very clear evidence that from that point forward, or 1990, 2000 in this particular case, the change of inequality, the increase in change, increasing inequality is a function or an event that favors the Democrats. Smaller increases in inequality leave a state prone to vote for the Republicans. So that's the basic story. I've got a few examples here that I want to share with you just to give you a feel for how particular states went. And you can see, for example, California, which in 72, 76, 1980, 84, and 88 voted for the Republican. And then as things moved along, and California, of course, is a leader in information technology, it shifted to Democrats and has been Democratic ever since. And in fact, it was a state that gave Mrs. Clinton a majority of about 4 million votes in 2016. And she lost the popular vote outside of California. New York, a very similar story. It was a slightly mixed pattern. The major event was its vote for Jimmy Carter in 1976. But after 1988, it has been solidly and increasingly Democratic. New Jersey, pretty much exactly the same. And Connecticut, what was in my youth a solidly Republican state, has flipped to be a Democratic state, also as inequality increased. And Nevada, an interesting recent case, has flipped as of 2008. So this is what we can see as a pattern. What does it portend for the future? and what does it portend for the election of 2020 in particular? I think the answer to that is that it poses a dilemma for the Democrats, because the states that Mrs. Clinton lost, which cost her the election that she was expecting to win, were Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. And these are all states in which the increase of economic inequality has been relatively slow, because, not because they've become richer in some sense, but because they haven't, because there is no center of a great center of finance in any of those states, and because the industrial centers, which used to be the source of high income and used to be the mainstay of the minority populations in Detroit and Milwaukee, Pittsburgh and so forth, have declined. And so the states have tilted back toward their traditional conservative rural electorates, which always existed, but were not always the predominant force. So they become a harder and harder reach for Democrats as time goes on. The contrary movement is underway, however, all across the American South. And you think Arizona could flip at any year because of the very rapid growth of the low-income Hispanic population by and large, as well as wealthy Californians who've moved into the state and their businesses which have moved into the state. Georgia almost elected a former student of mine, Stacey Abrams, the first African-American woman ever to be nominated for a Rhodes Scholarship from Mississippi, and as I say, a graduate of the LBJ School of Public Affairs. She was elected, in fact. She was only kept out of office by a very effective election fraud, suppression of voting, vote stealing, which is a highly developed skill in the American South. Let me think. There's Texas. And Texas is a state where Hillary Clinton did about 3 points better than Barack Obama in 2016 compared to 2012. The largest urban county in the state and one of the largest in the country, Harris County, Houston, solidly Democratic for the first time in decades. All the cities in Texas are Democratic, every major city. And the state is moving and almost elected a Democratic senator in 2018, admittedly against a man of whom it was said by a Republican that he sleeps in a coffin, but never mind, it was still a remarkably close-run thing. So Texas could shift as well. The dilemma for the Democrats is that the South isn't going to shift in 2020. Might not shift in 2024. By 2028, it will all be in play. Some of it in 2024. 2020 is not going quickly enough to make a difference to really, and we're not going to carry Texas. The Democrats are not carrying Texas or Georgia or maybe North Carolina, but probably not. So they've got to choose between the populist or the progressive old-fashioned appeal that might claw back Michigan or Wisconsin or Pennsylvania and a much more, basic appeal that spans their extremely diverse constituency. The loyalty of the minority communities and the interests of the urban professionals that will stand them in good stead in the South in the future, but probably not this time around. That said, I think if you're looking at the basic, if you're asking for a prediction of what's going to happen in this election, my bet is that a president who is running on the basis of an economy that hasn't fallen into recession, we'll see, and without having gotten the United States into a significant war, we'll see. If those two things hold for another year, I wouldn't bet against him. Thank you very much.